From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If you're trying to really understand the effect of the open-air nuclear tests conducted in the Nevada desert during the Cold War, you're going to have to go about it in different ways. There's the stuff you can measure, the medical studies, the documents, and then there are the stories. And the stories are the hardest part to verify because they're imperfect. People's memories are hardly ever reliable. But the writer Sarah Elizabeth Fox says the time has come for a new accounting of the Cold War, one where these stories of ordinary people who witnessed mushroom clouds or falling ash are given the credibility they deserve. Fox has written a book that pieces together the tools of science and folklore to get to the people's history of the nuclear West. She's joining us to talk about it after the news.
Whether you're new to the state or a native Utahn, some of you may wonder, why should I care about what's going on during the legislative session? With all that's happening nationally and locally, this year has a different feel to it. Issues are being debated by both officials and the public with a passion not seen in recent years. Find out the details and how they affect you. Check out KUBR's new podcast, 45 Days, on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Here's a big question for the show today. How can you trust a story? Because stories are fallible. Memories are imperfect. As someone who's studied folklore, Sarah Elizabeth Fox knows the meaning stories can convey, what they tell us about a place and a culture, how they give us a sense of loss and survival. But can they help us make definitive conclusions about a disputed history? The history she's been exploring and writing about for more than 10 years now is the history of the nuclear West, the open-air atomic bombs tested during the Cold War and the uranium mining that supported it. And so she's talked to people, to ranchers and farmers and housewives, the downwinders, the uranium-affected people of the West. In her book, she says in order to give these stories their full due, she approached them with different tools. There was the folklore part, of course, the cultural anthropology part. But she also used environmental studies and epidemiology. The book, she says, became a study of that most fundamental of human inclinations, that attempt to make sense of our experience through story. Her book is called Downwind, A People's History of the Nuclear West. And Sarah Elizabeth Fox is joining us to talk about it today. She is a folk historian and writer. She earned her master's degree at Utah State University in Logan. These days, she makes her home in Seattle. She's joining us from public radio station KUOW in Seattle. And Sarah Elizabeth Fox, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Doug.
Well, I mentioned that it took something like 10 years, maybe even more than 10 years, for you to get this book together. When you set out, did you figure it was going to take that long, I guess?
Honestly, I didn't set out to write a book. It started as my master's degree research for my history thesis at Utah State University in Logan in 2004. And at the time, it was a two-year research project. But I found that when I finished my thesis, I had a lot of questions that hadn't been answered yet.
What is it that made you keep digging? I mean, what was the thing that you figured you hadn't quite figured out yet that needed... I think what's unique about the book, and we'll talk about this, is that sort of conflation, which seems unique to me anyway, of the epidemiological stuff, the medical stuff, with the folklore part, you know, the stories part. So would you talk a little bit about that and how those things started to come together for you as you were thinking about this?
Sure. Well, I was really drawn to these stories as soon as I encountered them. When I first moved to Utah, I started seeing articles about the downwinders in the newspaper and started digging a little bit. I didn't know about the uranium aspect of the story at the time, so my research did start with the test site downwinders.
Right.
And I wanted to know if they could be true. I didn't have any reason to believe that people were telling stories that weren't true, but it seemed so fantastic and so shocking, and I couldn't believe that I'd never heard these stories before. As somebody who's passionate about history and passionate about the places and the people of the American West, I mean, this is my home. So initially approaching the stories as a historian, I figured there was really no way that I could correlate these sort of fantastic details that people were describing, you know, seeing mushroom clouds from their swing sets or from their clotheslines, cancer clusters that just defied imagination, you know, in very small towns and in close-knit families. And I was really moved by the stories, and I wanted to believe that it couldn't possibly be true, but I had a feeling that it was. And so my need to kind of build some context around those stories led me into the archives, into a lot of declassified federal documents so I could better understand what was going on, what kinds of activities were happening at the Nevada test site, what the Atomic Energy Commission knew about contamination, when they knew it. And I also needed to come at the stories with the tools of science, which were it was a leap for me because I'm not a scientist. But luckily, there are a lot of really remarkable researchers out there who've done a lot of looking into this. And so I was able to kind of bring their research to the table with these stories, these first-person narratives that I was hearing, and then these archival documents that I was digging up.
So you start with the stories, I guess. It's that experiential knowledge. Is that the jumping off point? That you can get to the, you know, to the documents, you can get to the epidemiological studies, the medical stuff, but you've got to have the story first. Is that the first part?
You do have to have the story first. I believe so, and that's certainly what drove my research, was an interest in starting with the story and going from there, having that be our jumping off point. And, you know, we can sit around for decades and look at historical documents as they emerge and look at research data as it's accumulated. But these stories are not going to be around forever.
Yeah.
The people who tell them are passing away. A number of the people I interviewed have died since I interviewed them. And I continuously hear stories from my contacts in Utah and in other affected areas about, you know, funerals that they're going to and people that have passed away. So the stories themselves are finite. And they're an important part of the historical record. And so I was motivated to try to document as many of them as I could while they were still around, because I think they add a lot to our conversation of, you know, nuclear technology and what it means to grow food and be dependent on the place that we live.
Yeah. I wanted to get some of the nuclear particulars that you learned out of the way. Give us a sense, just because you talk about how scale is important when you're talking about this story. Give us a sense of just how many tests we're talking about with the government, all told, if you can. I mean, I think you've done a tally here in the book.
Yeah, it's a big number and it's a complicated number because you can break it down a lot of different ways. But when I first came at this, I only knew about one nuclear test, and that was the Trinity test that happened in New Mexico in July of 1945, prior to the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Japan, the following month. I didn't realize that we had actually detonated other full-scale atomic weapons besides those three. And in fact, we detonated over 1,000 between 1945 and 1992, when our weapons testing program ceased. Now, from 1951 to 1962, those tests were conducted atmospherically in Nevada, which is to say above ground.
Right.
So they were taking nuclear weapons, many of them equally as large as the ones used in Japan, or many, many times larger, and detonating them from, they were dropping them out of airplanes, attaching them to towers and setting them off, weather balloons, shooting them out of cannons. All the branches of the military during this period are very interested in figuring out what the practical applications of this technology are for use in the military. And this is a very big destructive weapon. And as it develops, nobody really knows exactly how it's going to behave, which was the rationale for testing all of these bomb prototypes. So between 51 and 62, you have 100 atmospheric nuclear tests at the site in Nevada, which is just northeast of Las Vegas, about 65 miles to get to one of the entrances. And you also had, after 1962, quite a bit of underground nuclear testing. Atmospheric testing ceased after the test ban treaty in 1963, and all testing went underground, ostensibly to protect the citizenry. Mm-hmm. But it also made it a little bit more top secret during the Cold War arms race. So the underground testing is problematic, too. Obviously, you don't have quite as much contamination being generated in the atmosphere. But there's groundwater contamination that we don't really understand the full extent of. Periodically, those tested vent and release actual mushroom clouds just because of the force of the explosion, even though they were detonated very far, far underground. We also tested quite a few bombs in the Pacific.
Yeah, of course. And the question of why so many, you were saying, so they were trying to figure all this out. They wanted to know the practical applications. So there was a lot of fine-tuning going on. I get that. But what was interesting is you have to also take into account how much of this was about a show of power, because that was a dynamic. And in fact, you talked about how a lot of these U.S. weapons tests were kind of planned as a response to tests by the Soviets.
Yeah, to specific tests and specific bomb prototypes that both sides were developing. It literally was a race. You know, one side would achieve some progress and do something that had never been done before, and that pressured the other side to one-up that development. And so that was really what a lot of this weapons testing was a game of one-upmanship. The writer Rebecca Solnit calls it making war by display and displacement.
Well, another question on the issue of scale. How expensive was this? You've talked about this, and that seems stunning to me.
It was tremendously expensive. I was trying to find a total number, but you're looking at trillions of dollars over the course of the Cold War in building, designing, creating, deploying these different nuclear weapons types. I want to say the numbers are on $5 trillion.
Yeah. One of the big questions here, of course, is what did the government know about the danger of downwind testing in particular, and whether they were willing to sacrifice public health for that larger cause of national security? Do you think at this point you've come to figure out that calculus, how they were working that out?
To an extent, you know, it's a lot of historians have tackled this question, and it's a pretty big and complicated question. What did they know? When did they know it? How was, you know, this calculus of national security versus collateral, you know, environmental and civilian health problems here at home that were being caused by the testing? How was that math being figured out? And there's other historians that could probably speak to that more eloquently than I can. But what's clear is that by the inception of the nuclear testing program, you know, prior even to that first bomb being set off during the Manhattan Project, when they were first trying to build a nuclear weapon, they were studying the impacts of radiation on health, on the environment. You know, here in Washington, they were studying the way radiation was entering the farmland around the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, where they were producing the plutonium for the bombs.
Yeah.
They were gathering a lot of data very early on about radiation entering the food supply and reaching human populations. And they were well aware that it posed pretty substantial risk. There's a fair amount of documentation of that. And their hope was that the expanses of the West, you know, these big, wide open environments, often with very little water, would somehow kind of absorb the contamination, that there were few enough people and a big enough space that it would be spread out over an area where, you know, ultimately it wouldn't cause noticeable damage. But there were people there. There weren't... Yeah. Huge, densely populated communities, but there were communities that were actually small enough to have a sense of what was going on. You know, a cluster of health problems is easy to miss in a big city where people are moving around all the time and maybe don't know their neighbors. But in a small community, that stuff was hard to ignore.
I want to get to some stories. I want to talk about the Bullocks, McRae and Kern Bullock. So this gets us to this question of the effect on sheep ranchers, livestock in particular. How long did it take before, you know, when the testing began, before local sheep ranchers started to see problems with their flocks?
There's stories of people seeing issues very early on. There's a lot of folk narratives about even farmers themselves experiencing like skin rashes and noticing animals with birth defects as early as, you know, 1951 and 52 when testing starts in Nevada. But the sheep ranchers of Utah really start to become cognizant that this massive load of contamination is entering their environment in 1953. That was the year of the Upshot Knothole test series, which was the biggest series in that it was quite a few tests that took place in the spring of 53. They were very large bombs. you know, between 50 and 60 kilotons, a kiloton being 1,000 tons of dynamite.
Wow.
For comparison, the bombs we dropped on Japan were between 15 and 20 kilotons. So these were very big atmospheric tests, and they were hard to ignore. And Utah sheep ranchers were in a unique place to observe them because during that time of the year, they were all, quite a few ranchers were ranging their sheep mm-hmm. out in Nevada north of the test site. So the Bullock brothers were out there with about 2,000 head of sheep one morning in the spring of 1953. And they saw a cloud, you know, they saw the bright flash of a test going off. At that point, they were used to that. They'd seen quite a few.
But they didn't have any warning. We should say that, though, right? They didn't know.
No, there wasn't.
Of course, yeah.
No. Occasionally, tests would be announced for the purposes of it's hard to think of how to describe this, but publicity for tourism in Las Vegas and sometimes in the surrounding communities, people would find out ahead of time so they could take their kids out to watch the test going off
right.
or their friends in Vegas because it was history being made, yeah. you know, and it was this huge spectacle. The way people describe the mushroom cloud is with this incredible reverence and awe and dread, and they talked about it being beautiful. So periodically, people did find out that tests would be happening for those purposes, you know, kind of propaganda notions. But most of the time, there was no public announcement ahead of the tests, and certainly not one in the context of a safety warning. So even though these ranchers were extremely close to the test site, they and the Atomic Energy Commission knew they were there, they weren't ever going to warn them. And McRae Bullock told me later that he never was warned, not before that incident and not after.
Well, they heard this radio exchange this day, which is kind of heartbreaking. Would you talk a little bit about that story?
Yeah. So the brothers were actually encountered as they were herding sheep north of the test site by a vehicle full of military personnel. You know, at the time, I don't think they know whether they were AEC or military, but they described them as, you know, men in suits, kind of what we would think of as a hazmat suit. And they had, you know, Geiger counters and devices for measuring radiation. And they pulled up and they told the brothers, you're in a hot spot. You'd better get out of here. And here's Kern and McRae Bullock with 2,000 sheep who are heavy with lamb. You know, they're heading back to Cedar City to have their lambing season. They can't rush those sheep along. They don't move very fast. And to abandon them there and seek cover themselves, which you would have to go quite a ways to get undercover out in that part of Nevada, would have meant abandoning their family's livelihood. And so they stayed. And as they the radio exchange they heard was those military men that they encountered radioing to their commanders, there's two sheep ranchers out here. What do you want us to do about it? And it came back over the radio. There's quite a large number of people up at the mine up the way. So why don't you get up there and get them undercover and leave the sheep ranchers?
Forget about these sheep herders.
Forget about them. Well, there's nothing you can do.
Yeah.
If they're choosing not to evacuate, it's their own problem.
What they saw and what ranchers throughout that area were seeing, spots on their sheep, obviously, and horses, scabs, ewes were aborting lambs. Some were born with thin hides. There were all kinds of deformities. What was the explanation that was given to them? The Atomic Energy Commission tried to tell them that this was just malnutrition, you said.
Malnutrition. Well, there was it was a pretty remarkable process what happened. You know, these sheep ranchers were trying to figure out what was happening, why their herds were dying off in such a gruesome way. They talked to each other. They compared notes. They figured out that this was happening to lots of other sheep ranching families in the area. They called in local vets who couldn't figure it out. They called in the state agricultural extension agent who had a direct line, you know, to the Utah State Agricultural University System, you know, all the latest research. He couldn't figure it out, but he suspected that it might be radiation. He'd actually been given a Geiger counter by the Atomic Energy Commission to check for radiation on the range in that area. So he knew that it was present. So they notified state authorities. They notified the Atomic Energy Commission. And a big investigation was conducted because ultimately about 5,000 sheep died in that spring after the Upshot Knothole test series. And ultimately the verdict of the AEC was that it was malnutrition, which of course didn't go over very well in that part of Utah where the sheep industry at that time was, you know, generations old and steeped in experiential local knowledge. People knew their ranchers were good at what they did and that malnutrition was just a terrible explanation.
And you write about what happened to these ranchers. You mentioned many of them went bankrupt. A lot of them had to sell off their land. And some of them literally got physically sick. Some of them had heart attacks because of dealing with the stress of this situation.
Yeah, there's a story about a rancher named Doug Clark. He was extremely well-respected in the Cedar City sheep ranching community. He had been to college. He was a city council member at one point. And he was having a conversation. It was witnessed by Stephen Brower, who was the Utah agricultural agent. He was having a confrontation with this military expert. And he said, one of your veterinarians, told me that they had seen similar problems in studies they had done of radiation on livestock. And he was asking very specific questions. This is a pattern through the whole incident with the sheep, mm-hmm. is that these local ranchers are asking very specific questions. They've actually pinpointed how contamination has gotten to their animals. They understand that they ate it.
Yeah.
You know, they could see these spots on their hides and their faces, but they also are very attuned to what their animals are taking in, just so they can keep them healthy and keep them thriving. And they knew that they were grazing on crops or, you know, sage and brush that had this dust from the atomic test. And they could see their animals failing in a way that they'd never failed before. And they knew that was the new ingredient in the environment. And they were being responded to when they raised these very, you know, right on observations. They were being dismissed. They were being condescended to. And the military person who Doug Clark was having this conversation with was very condescending to him and insulted his intelligence. Mm-hmm. And a short time after
that, he was just a dumb sheep rancher, basically.
You're just a dumb sheep rancher. Yeah. People in that community, I heard the story about Doug Clark from so many different people who weren't there. People who had no ostensible connection to the sheep ranching industry knew the story of this honorable, well-educated, well-respected local businessman who'd been so insulted by this, you know, outside military expert. And Doug Clark had a heart attack later that day. And so the story lives on in the community, at least for those folks who remember it, as being really indicative of this larger attitude towards the people in this region, that maybe they were being treated as, you know, just dumb farmers or dumb rural people. And that really had a huge impact on people. And this is at the height of the Cold War,
right,
a time when questioning authority, questioning the government is very strongly discouraged.
Well, you write this. You write that the sense of nationalism began to wear off a bit. That here's how you put it in your book. Unquestioning loyalty became harder to give. And you say the government started to demand loyalty rather than to inspire it, which I think is interesting. And you start to see more and more confrontations, I guess, between local people and the federal government, I suppose.
Yes. The agency that's overseeing nuclear testing and actually the uranium industry as well is the Atomic Energy Commission,
right,
which was founded essentially to put nuclear technology in a they wanted to keep it outside of the military's hands, which I think was a noble aim. But of course, the AEC was very heavily influenced by the needs and requests of the military. And it operated with carte blanche, essentially, during the Cold War. There were really no other agencies that had oversight over the Atomic Energy Commission. So they did pretty much what they wanted and answered to no one.
You say ultimately the vast majority of unusual deaths and abnormalities among these sheep ranchers remained unexplained and uncompensated. So with the claims that they made to the government about this, just mostly they were completely dismissed, I guess?
Yeah, they took it to court in 1956, and the Atomic Energy Commission controlled all of the scientific data.
Right.
They controlled all of the expert witnesses. And so all these ranchers could do was take the stand and talk about what they'd seen. And the government's lawyers made them look, a lot of people talked later about how they made them look like fools, and right, they made them look like provincial, you know, ranchers, and they lost the case. What's really remarkable is that several decades later, as more and more attention started to be paid to the fact that maybe the dangers had been covered up or minimized and more digging started to be done, Utah Governor Scott Matheson ended up appointing a commission in the late 70s, and they found the documents where the Atomic Energy Commission confirmed that those sheep had died because of radiation exposure.
Wow.
And that information was withheld in the court of law because of reasons of national security. So in the early 80s, that original verdict was actually overturned, and the Bullock case, the Bullocks were the lead plaintiffs, but there were quite a few other ranchers involved in the lawsuit. They actually won their case in the same courtroom and before the same judge that originally heard that case. But it was overturned on appeal. So they, to this day, have not received any compensation for their losses.
This seems particularly cruel, to attack a people as being ignorant. I mean, one of the things you write about is that what would happen when a rancher would use the stories to make their case, you know, the phrase, they've never seen anything like it before. And that was one of those ideas that just sort of confirmed to them that these were just a bunch of ignorant sheep ranchers who had a bunch of stories. But you write about how the opposite is true, that this idea of experiential knowledge, even though it didn't work in the court case in this particular case, that the opposite is true, that these stories did ring true, I guess.
And ring true for people who needed to hear them, who were people who were also living in the downwind areas.
Right.
That experiential knowledge resonated very strongly with the ranchers' neighbors and friends and fellow churchgoers and journalists often. And people, for the very first time, were really starting to think critically about the messages they were being given by the government.
Sarah Elizabeth Fox is with us. We're talking with Sarah about her book, Downwind, A People's History of the Nuclear West. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the historian Sarah Elizabeth Fox. She's here to talk with us about her 10-year project to document the stories behind the nuclear tests conducted in the American West. She talked to downwinders. She talked to the people who populated the Great Basin when the U.S. detonated atomic bombs in the atmosphere as part of the Cold War. U.S. scientists waited until the wind was blowing east, by the way, to conduct a lot of those tests. And Fox says in her book, all wars occur in actual places where people live and grow food and raise children. And so she has the stories about all of this in her book called Downwind, A People's History of the Nuclear West. Let me ask you, one of the things you point out, of course, and you were mentioning earlier, was just how these locations were chosen because they weren't that populated, which meant, you know, rural areas. And what rural areas often means in the West is, of course, farms. And this is an important part of the story, how the people in these farms were able to witness the contamination of their food supply. And it was just sort of also a nice sort of memory, I have to say, that you heard. You heard from people like Mary Dixon talking about how in those days everyone had gardens. And so they had a direct access to how this contamination was coming into people's bodies through their phones, their food systems.
Yeah, absolutely. It's chilling because it's the kind of archetypal detail of a wholesome childhood, you know, growing your own food or living in a place where you know your farmer. And this sort of thing's very much in vogue nowadays, you know, knowing your farmer, knowing where your food comes from, growing a vegetable garden. You know, these are kind of trendy in this day and age because we've become really alienated from the production of our food in so many ways. Very distant from it. But in the 1950s in Utah, that couldn't have been further from the truth. Like Mary said, everyone gardened, everyone put up pickles or jam, everyone grew their own tomatoes. And if you didn't, someone in your family did, someone down the street did. And in order to be successful, you know, as every backyard gardener knows and every farmer and rancher, you have to be attuned to irrigation, precipitation, blights, pests, you know, all sorts of things that can destroy your harvest before you've had a chance to feed it to your family. So people were actually attuned to these environmental changes that were happening as a result of the uranium industry, as a result of nuclear testing, because it was directly and visibly affecting agriculture.
And probably in tune in a way that wouldn't happen today. I mean, you said the trend is coming back to growing things locally, but it's going to take a while for us to get back there. They were really deeply connected to the land in those days.
Absolutely. And you're talking about generational knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, even if we all start growing food in our backyard tomorrow, We have a lot of ground to make up. There's been a lot of alienation, especially in American society, from the process of food production. And so because of that alienation, we have to make up a lost ground and you know, reascertain this generational knowledge about how to grow food in a place. You know, and you look at areas across the American West, particularly, you know, in the American Southwest, where you have human civilizations, human communities growing food in a place for hundreds of years, places that are very challenging to make food thrive. You know, Utah is not, it's very arid in a lot of places. You know, you have the Great Salt Lake.
Yeah.
It's not what you would think of when you think of thriving agriculture. But Utah, you know, in the 1950s had at this point several generations of settlements that had thriving agriculture. And of course, you have indigenous communities also who have been gathering food and growing food in this area for generations.
And it seems
we just don't have that kind of knowledge anymore.
Yeah. And people were using what they were seeing in their gardens as a way to kind of counter what they were hearing from government sources who seemed to be telling them, for the most part, there's nothing to really worry about right now.
Well, it's this interesting question. I mean, who could be, what could have been more mysterious and clouded with you know, fantasy than nuclearism in the 1950s? You know, it's the stuff of all these comic books. It's this, you know, morally dubious question, you know, about this weaponry and the potential it has to destroy civilization. And most of the hard scientific knowledge about it is in the hands of a very few people who were trusting completely to keep us safe in this frightening global conflict.
Yeah.
And so for people to think critically about the messages they were being given by those who were the guardians of that knowledge, it's kind of a radical act in a way. And what kind of expertise could possibly compete with government scientists who worked in secret laboratories? What people had to do was look in their own backyards, look at what they knew, which was the place they lived. And the food that they fed their children. That was where they started.
I have to say there's this kind of sad epilogue to this section of the book about agriculture and food, because as the atomic age progresses, the culture of local agriculture recedes. And you write in the book that agriculture alone was no longer enough to sustain families economically, so young people start to leave these home communities. You said there's a trend heading back toward, you know, local growing of things, for example. But what do you make of this loss? Because you say, even though this change probably would have happened with or without all this nuclear contamination, their way of life had become poisoned by government negligence, and that just made it much more difficult to bear.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, well, you look today at the composition of a lot of communities in Utah, you know, like down in St. George, which was, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 people population during the atmospheric testing era. It was a small community.
Yeah.
Now it's this burgeoning retirement community. And I always, when I go to a town to do interviews, I ask for directions to the cemetery. And it's always interesting because, you know, I've invariably heard stories about people who lived in that community who, you know, spoke up about this issue. And, you know, I'd like to go visit them and see where they're buried. It's part of historians' due diligence. But
Right. Oftentimes
people can't tell me where the cemetery is. In St. George, I had to ask a couple of people before somebody could give me directions, which I thought was interesting because it's actually kind of right in town. But people are new to the area, so they don't have this generational memory, you know, or maybe they haven't been listening when their grandparents have been telling stories of what happened in this area. There's a lot of people in Utah that have no idea what it means to live downwind or that nuclear testing even occurred in Nevada.
A big part of the story, too, is the people who, I mean, these are people in rural communities, many of them very patriotic. Patriotism is a big element here in this story. And a lot of them were also from cultures that were not inclined to question the government, and the LDS culture in particular. Let me ask you, could you tell if the government, you know, consciously exploited Mormon populations, you know, took advantage of their discomfort with this idea of challenging authority?
It certainly benefited the Atomic Energy Commission in that most of the communities that were close enough, many of the communities, I should say, that were close enough to directly witness nuclear testing were LDS communities who were less inclined to raise a big public fuss during this period in history. You know, the church was very supportive of the government during the Cold War for interests in, you know, national security. And so it certainly benefited the AEC. I don't believe that they targeted that population because they were LDS or because they would, you know, possibly be less inclined to ask questions. I don't think it was deliberate. I think it was more luck, I guess, for the AEC and certainly bad luck for the people of Utah.
Yeah. What about the LDS Church itself? Because you recount a story of a woman named Darlene Phillips, for example, who spoke to the activist and writer Carol Gallagher, who had she raised questions to her church leaders and who's told her to just, you know, hey, we should be lucky that the government is doing something like that. Can you get a sense of how the LDS Church, like officially, I suppose, was reacting to all of this at the time?
Officially, the LDS Church was completely in support of weapons testing during this era. And I think that the message that Darlene Phillips got and that a lot of other people got, and Darlene actually took this to her bishop twice and was told twice to let the issue go. Yeah. She got explicit messages from her church leader about the affiliation with communism and that asking questions about what the AEC was up to or about the danger of nuclear testing or its contamination in milk, which was starting to come to light in the late 50s. He told her that that would associate her with communists and that it was her responsibility as a wife and as a mother to not ask those questions and to leave that kind of decision-making and that kind of questioning to men. And that is a message that a lot of women talk about getting from their church leaders during that time. So institutionally, you know, I haven't done as much research into, you know, what specific steps the church was taking, you know, to stand in support of the AEC. But at a local level, people were certainly being discouraged from asking questions.
Well, and more broadly, though, this idea of patriotism wasn't just obviously unique to the LDS culture. I mean, I'm guessing this was an issue all around the country in the 50s in particular,
Absolutely.
You know, because this was, you know, the Red Scare was fully on at that time.
Absolutely. You hear the same kind of patriotism in eastern Washington, you know, in the Tri-Cities area around Hanford. You heard the same kind of patriotism on the Navajo Reservation. The Navajo Tribal Council passed a resolution affirming their support of Cold War uranium extraction because they wanted to help win the Cold War. That was the message people were being given, that extracting uranium, refining uranium, refining it into plutonium in Hanford, mm-hmm. building these bombs, testing these bombs, that was national survival. And so the attitude in pretty much every community that was hosting or near nuclear activity during the Cold War, you know, during the 50s and 60s, there's a very strong feeling that, you know, to ask questions, the explicit message people are getting from their government is that to ask questions is actively undermining national security.
When we get back from a break, I want to talk a little bit more about the Native American experience, because you write a bit about that in your book. Sarah Elizabeth Fox is with us. Her book is Downwind, A People's History of the Nuclear West. We'll take another quick break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with the historian Sarah Elizabeth Fox. We're talking about her book, Downwind, A People's History of the Nuclear West. You point out early in the book how the U.S. military didn't hold legal title to all the land that it appropriated for all this testing. There were 17 different tribal groups that had claims to this land. Talk about that part of this story, the role that Native Americans played in this story.
Native Americans are displaced a lot in this story and yeah. bear a lot of the brunt of the really severe toxicity that's produced during the nuclear cycle. So the story, interestingly, you know, I thought the story began with the mushroom cloud. Mm-hmm. But I think that before there can be a mushroom cloud, obviously, you need to get that very volatile material out of the earth that you can then refine to fuel that tremendous explosion. And so this takes us to uranium country mm-hmm. Before we even get to the test site. And uranium country, you know, prior to at the beginning of the Manhattan Project, when they're first starting to build this bomb, you know, most of our uranium is coming from out of the country, which means it's vulnerable to wartime disruption. So there was this huge need for domestic uranium reserves because you needed a tremendous amount of uranium to refine into a very small amount of plutonium to build the bombs. So there was this federally sponsored mineral rush. The Atomic Energy Commission was the only authorized purchaser of uranium. They established this massive finding bonus. If you found a legitimate uranium claim, you got $10,000 just right off the bat from the federal government. So people just swarmed over Utah and kind of the Four Corners region because it was known that that was where most of our domestic uranium reserves were. And as it turned out, the vast majority of that uranium ended up being on the lands of Indian reservations, especially the Navajo Reservation and a lot of the Pueblo reservations. And so right off the bat, indigenous communities are playing host to the beginning of the nuclear fuel cycle, which is pretty contaminating in its own right.
How much time did you spend on reservations conducting interviews, talking to people about this part?
It was one good solid road trip in January, so there was a fair amount of snow. I didn't spend as much time as I would have liked, but I did interviews across Arizona and New Mexico in different indigenous communities. I spoke with individuals on the Hopi Reservation and the Navajo Reservation. And then I was able to – I didn't have the time or the finances to do more extensive interviewing, but there's a lot of amazing testimony that's already been documented, oral histories of indigenous uranium miners in particular that have been gathered by researchers and activists over the years. And so I was able to look at actually quite a bit of Native testimony about the way the uranium industry unfolded on Native land. And it was kind of a raw deal right from the outset. You know, there were all these wage labor jobs close to home, which was exciting for a lot of Navajo breadwinners and you know, other workers. But the health impacts of uranium mining were pretty dramatic and pretty serious. And the Public Health Service and the Atomic Energy Commission were actually doing a study on a lot of those miners starting in the early 1950s because they believed data was present that indicated a lot of people would get cancer. But they didn't share that information with the miners, many of whom moved their families to live at the mine sites with them. And so whole communities were really heavily exposed, you know, right at the beginning of the whole nuclear fuel cycle as uranium is being extracted and milled. And a tremendous amount of toxic waste was generated by this process, and much of it is still unreclaimed on Native American Indian reservations across the American West.
Would you say something about Dave Timothy and Ivan Sidney, their stories you tell in the book?
Dave Timothy was the son of a Utah dairy farmer up in Altona. Yep. And Ivan Sidney was a Hopi. He was growing up on his grandparents' farm, essentially, on the Hopi Indian Reservation. And then he later went to boarding school. They're about the same age. And so they're experiencing, unwittingly experiencing as their children, the impacts of atmospheric nuclear testing. They both live in communities that were downwind of the clouds that were generated by the nuclear tests in Nevada. And they both lived far enough away that they couldn't actually see the mushroom cloud. So they didn't have that story growing up like a lot of people in St. George did or Cedar City about actually seeing the mushroom cloud on the horizon. But they started to notice things that weren't right as they got older. They both grappled with illness as they got older. They both saw people in their families grappling with illness. And they both ended up piecing together after they got sick the way that they had gotten ill. And both of them pinpointed local agriculture and the contamination of local agriculture by nuclear testing as the cause of their illnesses.
The story of milk is interesting. This idea of the animals taking in the food and the effect that it has in spreading this contamination. And it's kind of a cloak and dagger story in some way. I mean, just the way they had to find the – I mean, there's a particular University of Utah scientist who comes into play. This is a really interesting part of the story.
Milk is a very interesting part. So, of course, in the 1950s, milk is the most wholesome food you could possibly have. I mean, it still has that reputation today. People are being encouraged to drink more milk than ever before in the 1950s. And the Utah dairy producers actually were getting together and doing a lot of advertising in the early 1950s to kind of get on that milk, patriotic milk consumption bandwagon. I mean, it was being explicitly linked to patriotism and national strength to drink milk. So What ended up happening was that milk became one of the primary vehicles for getting radioactive contamination out of the environment and into human bodies. So it's one radioisotope in particular that was causing such bad milk contamination and adverse health effects. It's iodine-131. It's one of many radioisotopes that's produced when you set off a nuclear bomb. So it's drifting down, you know, into the mountains, the Utah mountains. It's coming down in rain. It's drifting onto alfalfa fields, which there's quite a bit of alfalfa during this time, you know, across Utah. And a little tiny bit of iodine-131 on a blade of alfalfa isn't really going to hurt anyone. But a dairy cow can eat a tremendous amount of alfalfa. So they're gathering up that contamination. It's a process called biomagnification, where as you move up the food chain, the amount of contamination in the environment is concentrated. And of course, who's at the top of the food chain? We are. So by the time we drink milk or eat meat from an animal that, you know, has maybe consumed radioactive materials, we're getting a very high dose of particular radioisotopes. And radioiodine, iodine-131, seeks out the thyroid. So as children in the 1950s were drinking milk in Utah, they were actually drinking radioactive milk, and that iodine was seeking out their thyroids. And this was actually being studied at the time. There's a lot of Utah baby boomers who remember having their thyroids checked in elementary school by the Atomic Energy Commission or the Public Health Service. And data was being gathered about the thyroid problems that the government knew were going to emerge from that contamination. And Pendleton was a scientist. He had formerly worked at Hanford as a radiation oncologist. And then he moves to Utah, and he's at Utah, a University of Utah in Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. And one day he was out with a group of students, and they were taking measurements of granite, like radioactivity coming off of granite. And their reading suddenly went through the roof, and it didn't make any sense. And Pendleton figured out there had been a nuclear test. And he had a network of monitoring stations set up at Utah dairy farms because he was interested in the uptake of radioisotopes into the food supply. Yeah. But he was looking at cesium-137 right. and strontium-90. And they have different half-lives. They have different characteristics. And the AEC research agenda at that time was to focus on strontium-90. And in fact, an AEC representative once made the argument that the body of the dairy cow acts as a protection and it filters out strontium-90 before it gets to the consumer. They weren't looking at iodine-131. And so Pendleton, just out of curiosity, because he knows there's been this nuclear test the previous day, he goes out and he starts checking the milk at his monitoring stations across Utah. And he finds that it's extremely radioactive and that it's very, very high in iodine-131. And he recommends that that milk be diverted from public consumption, you know, into cheese production or something to give it time for that half-life to pass and for the iodine-131 to not be dangerous anymore. And he's told that he's going to cause a public health crisis by causing people to depress their calcium intake.
Which is crazy.
It sounds ludicrous today, but obviously the real concern was that there would be a panic.
Of course.
Milk has this incredible significance to us as a source of nurturing and sustenance. And to let people know that very substance that they're feeding their children, you know, multiple glasses of every day is radioactive and could get them very sick, that would probably generate a lot of public opposition to nuclear testing in Nevada. So that information is not shared with the public. And many years later, in 1997, the National Cancer Institute released a thyroid cancer study looking explicitly at the connection between fallout, milk, and thyroid problems. And they found a significant connection between thyroid problems in the downwind regions and radioactive iodine entering the milk supply after nuclear testing.
You say in your book that downwinders, radiation affected people tend to remain a side note in this bigger discussion about the atomic West. I wanted to ask you about that because you say when downwinders are acknowledged, they're usually talked about as quote unquote local color. And you say they become these kind of folk stock characters, these two dimensional kinds of characters. Is that still the case, do you think?
I think it is to some extent. Westerners have always been kind of looked at by people in positions of power and authority and Easterners as being a little bit more provincial mm-hmm. and maybe having a little bit less education and a little bit less sense of the bigger picture. We get written off as being trapped by our regions somehow. And So these stories still today, sometimes when you see them in the newspaper, you see phrases like salt of the earth, mm-hmm. and you know, earnest. They were earnest ranchers. They were earnest Americans. All of those things are true. But what's concerning to me is that they aren't often given a lot of voice beyond that.
Right.
To articulate what's actually a very complex understanding of how contamination entered their communities, entered their food supply, how the messages about that contamination were received and played out historically. They're extremely well informed. They've done a lot of research. You know, any parent who has a child who's dealing with cancer has to learn how to ask a lot of questions and do a lot of digging to advocate for their child as they deal with this unknown disease. And so to talk about the downwinders or the uranium-affected people only based on, you know, what they did for a living and what their zip code was, I think it doesn't happen so much anymore. Journalists today, I think, are doing a really good job of creating more nuanced accounts and giving more weight to this testimony. But for many, many, many years, the downwinders and the uranium-affected people have been dismissed based on those characteristics, those provincial characteristics they're so often ascribed.
You quote Wendell Berry. I mean, you raised this question of what is lost if people do not remember what has happened in their communities. This idea of divorcing the tragedies of these narratives from the cultural process. You can't dismiss, because it's easy to dismiss. We don't have a lot of time left to talk about this, maybe a minute. But it's easy to dismiss memories as being fallible, as being imperfect. What you're trying to do is put them back into the story and into the process and say, we have to take this into account in the bigger
Absolutely.
Picture, I guess.
Memory is fallible. We all realize that. We all realize our own memories are fallible. But what I realized in the course of doing this research is that the official records are also fallible. We need to ask critical questions not only of our own memories and, you know, the memories of our other people in our community, but of the documents and the newspaper reportage and the journalism that's given to us to consume. So memory is fallible, but so is the documentary record, and the truth lies somewhere in the middle.
Sarah Elizabeth Fox. Her book is Downwind, A People's History of the Nuclear West. Sarah, thanks very much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.